Okay, when we left off last time, it's been a few weeks. When we left off last time, we were talking about appropriate punishments for rebellion against authority, and we talked some about corporal punishment. And I want to come back and wrap that discussion up today before transitioning to the last topic that I want to address in this series. But what I'm going to speak with you about today is something that I've talked about in passing on numerous occasions, but I haven't dealt with it in any detail. And I thought, because I had mentioned this before in passing, that maybe I would skip over it. But then I decided it needs to be addressed in some sort of more substantive way, and especially in light of events in the news last week in regard to the shooting that took place in the church in Texas. And I'll explain how all these are connected here a little bit later. But in particular, again, today I'm looking at rebellion to authority and what the Bible sets forth as appropriate or just penalties for rebellion to authority. And there's one case law in particular in Deuteronomy 21 that I want to look at, though there are other passages as well that we'll mention in passing in regard to this. Long story short, the Bible sets forth the death penalty as a, and I'll say this, possible sanction for rebellion to authority. Exodus 21 says that a person who strikes father or mother or curses them, and this is not just, you know, this is a curse in this, you know, sense is, you know, I hope you die, go to hell, that sort of thing. The Bible prescribes capital punishment for those things. More than that, we have a case law, the famous case of the rebellious son set forth in Deuteronomy 21, which allows for parents to take an incorrigible, rebellious son before the elders of the city who, after hearing the complaints against the son, proceed to stone the son to death. I want to read that passage in particular. This is Deuteronomy 21, verses 18 and following. It says, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city, to the gate of his city. And they shall say to the elders of his city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear in fear. This passage is one that is cited very frequently by critics of Old Testament law as evidence that we should not consider Old Testament penal sanctions as applicable in the New Covenant. Obviously, this law is too harsh for our modern sensibilities. When someone speaks about, you know, application of Old Testament law today, this passage is one of the first that are cited. If we implemented Old Covenant sanctions, that would mean we would be stoning children to death. Okay? That's the mentality. That's the argument. Now, you recall, I've said before, usually if we have a problem with something in God's Word, sometimes we don't understand the rationale, but we should say, you know, if I've got a problem with it, the problem's with me, God's a good God. God's a just God. And Hebrews 2:2 says that speaking about the Old Testament, that every infraction received a just reward. So every time we think something is too harsh, the problem's with us. In God's justice, the punishment always fits the crime. And so what we have to do is change our thinking. And a lot of times that happens as a result of coming to understand how the law actually functions and what is that motivation? What is the impetus behind that law? And I think if we take the time to explore that, we'll see that this law in fact is not harsh. It is in reality, it's just and it's merciful. It has the intention not only the restoration of the rebellious son, but also the protection of society against a career criminal class. Okay? To explain, let me point out letter B. I said to counter this charge, several factors must be taken into consideration. All right. Going back to what we just said, in the Bible, the punishment always fits the crime. And if a person seeks to completely destroy or rebel against lawful authority, the appropriate punishment is the destruction of that person by a legitimate authority. Okay, there is the lex talionis, the law of compensatory retribution principle at work here. More than that, in regard to the case of the rebellious son, we need to point out this is not a child. Okay, this is not a little child who's throwing temper tantrums. Now, he probably did that when he was a child, no doubt. But this is what is presented here is obviously someone who is older, who is incorrigible. These are not parents who are just having a frustrating day. You know, the kids have pushed them to the limit that day. And we're going to take the son out and stone him. The son described here is said to be a glutton and a drunkard. Okay? It's not a coincidence. I mentioned in the past when the Pharisees called Jesus a glutton and a drunkard, they were implying this Old Testament law. They were saying, you are the rebellious son. You deserve to die. And they're prefiguring, by saying that, they're prefiguring their intention to crucify him. Okay? So this is, you know, I don't know how old he is or whatever, but he's old enough to be a glutton and a drunkard, and he demonstrates he's entrenched in a persistent pattern of rebellious behavior, and the parents have made many unsuccessful attempts to correct his behavior, all to no avail. And it is only after this that they take the more severe step of bringing him before the civil authorities. Okay? We need to make it clear this is not a case of honor killing such as in Muslim countries. My child did something, brought shame on the family, and therefore I'm going to take him out and kill him with the sanction of the law. This is a case in which you bring the rebellious son before the elders of the city who are going to hear out the case. And remember, we talked briefly before about abuse of parental authority. There are laws in the Bible. You abuse your authority, then the slave goes free. By implication, if a parent is seen to be abusive, then that child might be extricated from that family. And so if the parents are bringing the rebellious son to the civil magistrates have a responsibility to look into the situation to determine whether what the parents are are saying in regard to the Son is in fact true. Yes, sir. Rebellious son court, you know, like the people's court. Yeah. There would probably be some interesting stories, wouldn't there? You know? Yeah. Finally, let's point out, parents are usually the last to admit the truth, about the hopelessness of their children. You see, sometimes TV, some guy, you know, he's got this record a mile long and now he's been arrested for murder and, you know, the mom is like, I don't believe he did that. He's a good boy, you know, and you're like, you see, he's been arrested 14 times, right? You know, how often would this have happened? It seems, very unlikely that it would happen a lot. Now, sometimes there are parents who, you know, turn their children in. They understand, you know, this is what needs to be done. Above all this, though, we have to remember that the death penalty was allowed in cases that warranted. But the victim always had the right to be lenient. Again, the only time when the death penalty was absolutely required is in the case of murder. In every other case, the victim of the crime can sue for punishment up to the law's limit, whatever, in regard to whatever the fraction was, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. But always had incentive for leniency, and oftentimes could be. Yes, sir.
How do we know that again? I mean, where's the principle found?
Well, the place that it comes to mind most clearly is in Proverbs 6, but it's implicit in many of the other laws. What we see in Proverbs 6, there's a distinction made between a person who steals because they're hungry and the person who catches a man with his wife committing adultery. And says, in essence, that, you know, no one despises a thief if he steals because he's hungry. But the man who catches a someone with his wife is not going to be lenient in the day of judgment. So the law said death penalty for adultery, but it did not require that. Okay. That's the one. There are other places and implications of that. That's the one that it seems most clear. Okay. Yeah. No, I think those are just illustrations. I think the big issue is persistent rebellion to authority. We have to remember, gluttony and drunkenness were not crimes. They were sins punishable by God, but not by the state. If I want to go get drunk, be gluttonous, and gluttony is not about overeating in Scripture. It's riotous, excessive living. But those, what those were, I think, were evidences of a persistent rebellious lifestyle, repeated attempts at correction, and the child will not be corrected. In this case, young adult. Okay? But going back to my point here about leniency, I mean, you expect, you know, leniency would be pretty common in the case of one's own children. There's something about, you know, that filial relationship that you know, the bonds of biology. When God told 2 Samuel 7, David wants to build God a house, and God sends Nathan to David. He says, no, I'm going to build you a house. And God essentially tells David his family is going to be the royal family, that from his descendants will come the Messiah. And God says, my mercy will not depart from him as it did from the house of Saul. In other words, Saul's family is not going to continue as the royal family. But he guarantees that David's family, David's descendant, will be the Messiah. And God says, because I will be a father to him, and he will be to me a son. And I will chasten him, but my mercy will not depart from him. And so that's why, even though you've got a lot of Davidic kings who are sinful, the Davidic line is still the royal line. Because God is going to be a father to the son. And by the way, in the Gospels, when somebody says, Jesus says, you're the Son of God, they were not thinking second person of the Trinity. That never entered the mind. They didn't have the Trinity figured out. Son of God was a royal messianic title, which meant the Davidic heir who would be king. Which is why every time somebody calls Jesus the Son of God, he's like, don't tell anybody. We don't need the Romans going around hearing people call me king. Yeah.
So would it might have been an accidental tie, then accidental, so speaking, that the Pharisees didn't intend it whenever they said he's a glutton and drunkard. So because at that point, making that claim, they really are claiming not just this Davidic heir, the actual, like, you are the Son of God. It's implicit in their words, as in God's Son.
Yeah, I think. Little did people know that Jesus was Son in a whole different sense. I think that becomes clearer afterwards. But I think initially that's a messianic term, and that's all people are thinking. I don't think anybody believed Jesus was God in the flesh really until after the resurrection. Sometimes, unfortunately, our Bibles, you hear the wise men came and worshiped him. But that word just means pay homage. Maybe there were some who understood Jesus was God in the flesh. I don't know if, you know, Anna or Simeon or something like that. I don't think the disciples understood that. The people all thought Jesus was a prophet. Who do people say that I, the Son of Man, am? Okay? John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah, one of the prophets. Just because Jesus was doing miracles didn't mean he was God. It just meant God was working through him. God worked through Moses and Elijah and Elisha and did miracles. Later on, they figure out in the other sense, Jesus is Son of God in second person of the Trinity. Yeah. Right. Yeah, getting. Okay. All right. So I bring that up, that God says, I'll be a father to him. He will be my son. My mercy will not depart from him. Parents are the most likely to be merciful to their children. Okay? So let's keep all that in mind. Just because this case law exists doesn't mean that you were going to have parents lined up around the courthouse with their kids taking them to be stoned all the time. Okay? Just not the case. Do what?
Here's
another one of those case laws where you have that formula attached, so all Israel shall hear in fear. Again, let's say this did happen on a few occasions, though. That would send a strong message, you know? We're going to be going to the elders, you know? Can't get out of line. Going to the elders, you know? Whatever. Okay, you could do that. All right, number five here. Let me mention this at the bottom page. Above all, the future consequences of persistent rebellion against authority must be weighed with the cost to society that will be endured if persistent evil is allowed to go unhindered. As Vern Poitras explains, the death penalty for wholesale violation of parental authority may seem harsh to modern sentiments, but I would argue that it is not only just but realistic. Parental authority, even if very imperfectly exercised, takes place in the context of personal relationships and natural pressures in the direction of love. Parents have many advantages over the state. If a person does not receive instruction from parents, the chances of receiving instruction from the state's more impersonal discipline are nil. The person who rebels in wholesale fashion against parents will also rebel against the state and create general destruction and disorder until eliminated. It is mere sentimentality to refuse to come to grips with this reality. If the child won't heed, you know, his parents' instruction, odds are he's going to grow up and be, you know, a person who's not going to heed the state's instruction. Okay? Well, here's where this law of basically escalating things by taking the assumed older rebellious son to the court is intended to, as a gracious act, to correct the son's behavior. Let's look at page 2 there, the grace of law. Okay? Just reiterating what we said before, that only capital punishment is only required in the case of murder. Ordinarily, the victim determines the punishment up to the law's limit. In the case of murder, though, the victim cannot be lenient. It cannot enforce the sanction. So the state acts where the victim would. The state acts on behalf of the deceased victim, administering an life for life punishment. That's not the case with a situation involving a rebellious son. Let me read letter B here. This is not the case with situations involving a rebellious son. In this scenario, parents bring their son before civil authorities to complain about his conduct. Upon conviction, the judge might recommend an appropriate penalty, but in the end, the state would enforce the penalty specified by the parents. While the prescribed penalty will almost certainly be less than capital punishment, the fact that his parents brought him before civil authorities would likely make the son obey his parents more readily in the future, since he would know they might take him back to the civil authorities again and insist on escalating the penalty. Hence, the fear of the state's more severe sanction would reinforce the parents' authority in the home. Suppose, in other words, like your child just will not obey. You take the child to the civil authorities. And remember, we said that the state could administer a beating. It could do no permanent damage, but the 40 lashes up to that limit. Let's say you took your rebellious son to the state administered corporal punishment. In the future, the son would know that you mean business by taking the child to the state, and there was always that threat that you could do so again. And the time may come where the parents are exasperated with the child, and they could potentially, again, how often this would happen, I would think it would be not frequently, but they could call for the capital sanction. And so what would happen is that this threat of greater force then serves to make it backs up the parental authority. Okay, it's kind of when I was a child, well, my mom could administer discipline herself, but you would rather get in trouble with mom than with dad. When dad gets home, you know, and the thing about that, you know, there was that time, you know, if it was noon and you know dad's going to get home at 4:30 or whatever, you got that 4.5 hours of, oh no, you know. Because, I mean, dad, you know, if I was disrespectful to mom, back in the days of straight razors, you know, you had the old razor strap. Okay, that was the preferred method of in my house. You know, dad would spank you, and when dad spanked, you felt it. Well, it's like that at school sometimes. I mean, most time I don't have, you know, bad rebellious behavior. I handle pretty much everything in house. But there's times something has warranted me sending, a kid to the principal's office to escalate matters. If I'm not, you know, having success and it just continues, I've said in the past that there are times where I sure wish I had a paddle. You know, we don't today, and the kids kind of know it. But if they're sent to the office, I don't think that's a particularly scary thing. But the one thing is, if a child is sent to the office, their parents are notified. And if their parents are notified, most of the time the parents will be taken care of. The parents are usually really good with backing us up. Every now and then, you know, you'll have that one where their child just can't do anything bad, and you meet them, and before you know it, you're kind of sympathizing with the poor kid. You know, he didn't have a chance, you know, that kind of thing. But 98% of the time, parents got your back, and they'll take care of it, and that corrects behavior. So that's kind of the mentality that's going on here. You have this, you're at the end of your limit. You're not having any success with changing this incorrigible child. And so you escalate matters by taking them to the state. And there's always that threat of the greater punishment. Let me read what Gary North says. What if they refuse to bring a formal child against their rebellious son? Then they have implicitly subsidized evil behavior. They have implicitly sanctioned it. They know that they are risking the possibility that he will become an incorrigible adult. If he does, they will lose him anyway. Better to bring him before the civil court early. Better to obey God. Better to avoid God's sanctions against the family for the parents' refusal to obey. The son may learn fear of the civil court, even though he has no fear of the family court. I want us to think about this too, in bringing a child before the civil court. Implicit in this law is what Jesus says when he says, "He who loves father and mother more than me is not worthy than me." The Bible calls on us to put God first, even above family relations. Now, if the family members are Christian, you know, that's one thing. But what is envisioned here oftentimes, I think, if making a choice for Christ puts you at odds with your family, well, you got to make the choice for Christ. What Jesus comes out and says explicitly was already inherent in the law. Okay? You can see it in this case law. Are you going to obey me by bringing this incorrigible son to the court? Or are you going to subsidize evil because he's your child and refuse to do that? Remember what I said before, that the Levites were granted the priesthood because they put God's honor above family relations. After the golden calf incident, when Moses caused the people to drink the ground up, you know, the tablets ground up into the water, and it identified those who had engaged in idolatry, he said, "Who is on the Lord's side?" The tribe of Levi flocked to him. And the Levites went through and killed the idolaters. Later on, when the blessing is being pronounced, when Jacob's pronouncing the blessings on the tribes, that is noted that Levi put God above family members. That seems to be the reason why the tribe of Levi was awarded the priesthood. So when Jesus says, "He who loves father and mother more than me isn't worthy of me," he's like, to be my priest, you have to put me first. Okay? Even if that means being at odds with your family. Okay? Same principle when the proverb says that a good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children, and the wealth of the wicked is laid up for the just. What that's saying is, if I have two children, ordinarily I would divide my estate into three parts. The firstborn would get a double portion, but that firstborn child is now responsible for caring for me in my old age. That's why it gets more money. But if that firstborn child is a rebellious son, then the wealth of the wicked is laid up for the just. Okay? Sentimentally, parents generally won't do that. Okay? Of course, we got Social Security to take care of us, right? It's going to be there for us all. Now, if you were dependent, and let's say your firstborn son is rebellious and is a glutton and a drunkard and is blowing the money, that's your future at stake. It's not without coincidence, I think, when Jesus is on the cross, Jesus has four brothers, he's firstborn, but he's on the cross, and what does he do? Woman, behold your son. Son, behold your mother. He entrusts Mary to the care of John rather than his brothers, because his brothers did not believe in him until after the resurrection. We're told Mary went into his house from that day. Jesus had a responsibility to care for Mary. He's dying, and so he's entrusting. He's bypassing, disinheriting his brothers, basically. Bypassing them and entrusting Mary to John's care. Now, Jesus makes an appearance to James afterwards, and he becomes leader of the Jerusalem church. So it's quite possible that Mary then went to James's house. We don't know. We're not told. I just say that parents had that obligation then to put doing what's right above sentimentality. Suppose you have laid up an inheritance for your children's children. You do not want to take resources that are built up over time to give to someone who's not going to use them to advance the kingdom. You can't be sentimental. Okay? You have to give it to the ones who are faithful. Now, those others, they might later repent. Okay? But you got to make the choice you make at the time you make it. Think about the prodigal son. When the elder brother complained, the father said, because you didn't have a feast for me and all this, and the father said, all that I have is yours. Okay? The prodigal son had already blown his inheritance. The elder brother still got, you know, everything that was left. Okay? So all these laws are kind of interwoven. I've said before, contrary to what we say, blood is thicker than water. Water is thicker than blood, as far as the Bible is concerned. Baptism is, the bonds of baptism are greater than our familiar bonds. Now, a lot of times, praise God, that they're one and the same. Our family members are also our, you know, united to us in the covenant.
Is the church,
sure. I mean, and it can be multiple. It could be multiple authorities, multiple punishment. A person could be excommunicated, and they could be disciplined by the state. It's like adultery. You know, if committed adultery in Old Testament Israel, you might be punished by the state. You might also be excommunicated by the church. Okay. Well, here's yes, sir. No, I'm saying this is how it should be. This is what the state should do. I'm wanting to defend, I'm wanting to defend this case law against those who believe it's harsh, etc. Today, how would we apply it? No, I think what we'd have to do is, the best the church could do would be excommunication. I think a parent may sometimes call up the police and say, come, you know, my son committed this crime rather than covering for him or something like that. But yeah, no, today in our situation, you know, we'd have to do what we can do with our limits. Okay. There wasn't a specific case law, but God said he would judge the nation. Okay? So God, if a society doesn't do this, God promises to vomit people, the nation out of the land.
It seems like there would be application, but I could use that as an instance of,
but it's that persistent rebellion to authority, the refusal to repent, that makes it punishable by death. It's that like the ox that tended to gore in the past, and you haven't done anything about it. What it does, and my last point I'm going to make, it eliminates a professional criminal class. This would do away with prisons entirely. Get to that in a second. Debbie, you had a question. Right.
Society, I think some of the consequences of them not dealing with their child the way they should have are going to be natural consequences.
Gonna bring up parents to shame, that sort of thing. But there are a lot of consequences to society that God warns about. And this is my last point. This is the thing. This is what prompted me to go ahead and deal with this, even though I've talked about this case law at times along the way. Let's look at this. Number three, avoidance. Let me read that last quote under C, and then I'll go to three. If they bring him several times, the court will undoubtedly recommend increased sanctions. He has been identified as an incorrigible youth. The day that he commits a crime against someone outside his family, the court will be able to demonstrate to the victim that leniency is no solution, that this man is a habitual criminal. Thus, by allowing parents to insist on the death penalty, but by also allowing them to be lenient, God encourages parents to identify rebellious sons before the latter become incorrigible criminals. The court can take steps to enforce parentally recommended sanctions before it is too late. Okay, so in other words, now the person has done more than just rebel against parental authority. Now they've gone out and committed a crime, and the person who has been committed a crime then doesn't have a family relationship to him. He's less likely to be lenient, and the judges might say, you know what, this kid's been before us, you know, several times now. I would not advise leniency. And the person who doesn't have that family ties would be more likely to say, yeah, the top sanction. Okay? Let's think about this. Avoidance of a professional criminal class. Let me just read this. Dr. Rushdoony has observed that the application of the death penalty to the rebellious son is an act of mercy to society, and that it prevents the development of a professional criminal class of repeat offenders who invariably do more harm to others because sufficient efforts are not made to curb evil before it is allowed to escalate. Moreover, if God's law in this respect is denied, the penalty is God will judge the nation. Hence, and I'm quoting Rush Dooney, the godly exercise of capital punishment cleanses the land of evil and protects the righteous. In calling for the death of incorrigible juvenile delinquents, which means therefore in terms of case law, the death of incorrigible adult delinquents, the law declares, so shall you put evil away from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. Okay? Think about this. In biblical law, a person may be temporarily held while they wait trial. But after that, the punishment is either you make restitution, you make restoration to the victim who determines punishment up to limited amount, or you're beaten, or you're executed. There is no prison system. What we do, instead of saying, you've rebelled again and again and again, enough, you're a menace to society, we put them away for a period of time. In inhumane situations, surrounded by other, you know, the Bible says you walk with the wise, you will be wise. You know, I talk with this about parents, and sometimes when they have six kids and they're so different, and the classroom that kid is in has tremendous effect. Even though they come from the same family, and you see a consistency usually. But we're discipled by who we are with. Okay? It talks about the disciples after Jesus' resurrection, and they're still preaching, and I can't remember where it is, but it says they had perceived that they had been with Jesus. Okay? They didn't just sit under his teaching. We're being discipled all the time, consciously, you know, unconsciously, by who we were with. So if we walk with the wise, we will become wise. If we walk in the company of fools, we become fools. We adopt their ways. And so what we do is we take criminals and we put them in with what? A bunch of other criminals. And they learn to become career criminals. And which is why, you know, there are so many repeat offenders. And when we permit that sort of thing in society, not only are we increasing the chances that when this person gets out, oftentimes they're going to commit crimes again, but we're being unmerciful to society. So often we talk about mercy to the offender rather than mercy to the victim, rather than mercy to the society. And the reason why I thought this week, I decided to go ahead and address this, the guy last week that went in and shot up the church, had been arrested multiple times, been dishonorably discharged from the military. And so there are people who obviously don't have a record, and they go out and they do something horrendous. Okay? The guy in Vegas, apparently. Of course, who knows? That's all seems so weird and everything. But many times, way too many times, people will commit serious crimes and they have a rap sheet a mile long. And they have learned, I can get away with this. All it's going to do is I'm going to get slapped on the wrist and I'll be back out on the street and I'll do it again and I'll do it again and I'll do it again until I do something more serious. This law would prevent that. It would end the, you know, if we did this, it would end prison system as we know it. And it would be an act of mercy to society. Okay, let me read this letter B here. It says, when a society ignores the death penalty for persistent rebellion against authority, it by that action allows criminals to persist in their crimes, while denying the innocent their right to live in peace and safety. In doing so, the state provides mercy for the persistent criminal while denying mercy to its present and future victims. In other words, while the denial of capital punishment for persistent offenders may evidence a form of pity, in reality it misplaces pity by giving it to the offender rather than the offended. By contrast, the purpose of the sanction against persistent rebellion against authority is elimination of a professional criminal class from society. We've talked about this sometimes at school when we have a child who is persistently in trouble. And, you know, we want to be this community of grace and mercy. And sometimes we have to say, what about grace and mercy to the children who are here who want to learn? What about grace and mercy to the teachers? And it has to be pretty serious, you know, for us to have a situation. But sometimes you have to balance being gracious and merciful to this child with being gracious and merciful to those who are having to deal with this person. The same sort of principle applies, that it's not gracious, it's not merciful to allow someone to persist in rebellion until they do something severe. This would send a law like this, and here we're talking about institutional injustices. I mean, that's what we see. Our prison system today, our failure to do this is a judgment of God on our society. Okay? It's unjust to law-abiding citizens. Okay? That's the problem. Just note there, numerous times in the case laws, and I've just given you some examples from Deuteronomy, God says, when he says, enact this penalty, and he says, you shall not pity. And you can look at all those passages, Deuteronomy 7, 16, 13, 69, 19, 11, 13. God understands we're going to have a tendency to want to pity. We don't want to do those things. But so often it's easy for us to misplace pity. And so the law repeatedly warns, don't pity. You have to consider pity for this person in conjunction with pity for his present or future victims. That makes sense? Any other questions or comments? You got an order of worship. You want to sing a song?
Yeah.
Okay.
I had a question, though, too, but I suppose this could be a lengthy discussion. Maybe not later. Just a question about the authority of who can actually execute the death penalty. So what is that? State is given an authority. Mm-hmm. So the guy who went and shot, I mean, I would have done the same thing. I would have shot that guy, but did he actually have political authority to do that? In other words, the fellow who drove up, the neighbor who ended up shooting the fellow who was shooting at the church. I get confused about that sometimes. But, I think I can in reaction, I would have done the same thing. But biblically speaking, who has authority?
Yeah, there is, in the case law, there is permission to take the life of another in protection of life. In Exodus 22, verse 2 and following, if the thief is found breaking in and he is struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. If the sun rises on him, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed. He shall make full restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If the theft is certainly found in his hand, whether it's an ox or a donkey, he shall restore double. What this is saying, okay, so you if somebody's stealing, I can't shoot them for stealing. That doesn't warrant it. That the punishment exceeds the crime. But the reference to the sun has risen on him. If someone breaks into my home at night, I don't know why he's there. I'm given the benefit of the doubt. It's basically open season. Okay? If I come home and the guy's in my garage and he's breaking in, I don't have the authority to shoot him for that. But the assumption is there that he's breaking in my home at night and I shoot him, then I'm off the hook. There's no penalty for me because I'm assuming he's there to do harm to me. So the Bible recognizes the right of self-defense. I guess you could question, should the guy have jumped in the truck and followed him? There's another thing, I guess, now that you have, You know, if not, if you just call it in and say the guy's leaving in the truck, then he's got the chance of getting away. So that might be, that's something for lawyers, I guess, to figure. But I think the Bible clearly does allow us to take the life in defense of life. If that makes sense.
So that principle of when someone is breaking into your home during the night, you think that's applicable more broadly?
I think it definitely establishes the right of self-defense. I'll get to you in 1 second. Now, obviously, if somebody's coming in during the day and they got a gun, then yeah, I mean, there's threat, you know. I think that's the principle.